Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage. Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise. Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Make it so. Make it so. Make it so.
First duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth. Scientific truth or historical truth.
Yeah, The Martian did actually really well, I think.
Yeah. Oh, no, it did great. I mean, it's a Matt Damon movie.
Why wouldn't it do great?
Right.
It's never derailing.
I don't think it is. In fact, he gets in trouble when he does, like, the green zone. Like, that didn't do well.
No.
He should stay in the red.
Yeah, you're right.
Ironically, from a accounting perspective.
Yeah, the red does great wonders for Matt Damon, not the green.
Speaking of aliens, you saw the Darmok episode of Next Generation recently for the first time.
I did.
Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes.
Oh no, they're talking about Star Trek.
Be
over real
off.
Fast.
No.
But it's a classic. I mean, it's certainly what I think is at the height. It might be the best episode of the show. I don't know. But it's probably one of them because you're coming off that great, the great third season, the fairly good fourth season with a few, like,
right.
Look, they can't all be good, so these are going to be just terrible.
Some fillers.
Yeah. And then the show until, maybe season 7, stays pretty strong up until the end, and I think this is the second episode of the fifth season.
Yeah.
And they just bust it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a bottle episode, but it's not. It's deceptive because you've just got Paul Winfield and Patrick Stewart standing in a field fighting the electro triceratops creature that we never actually see.
Yeah.
So you don't have to work on that too hard in the model, right?
Right.
But then there's like another ship and there's other aliens and they're using all the sets and then Ashley Judd is now on the show. And
right.
So it probably cost as much, if not more, than a regular episode.
Probably. And the thing that's interesting, too, is it's like they've apparently tried to communicate with these aliens before, but it just hasn't worked. And
for over 100 years.
Yeah. And this
and it's
captain
never come to firing shots until they got William Riker involved. So
yeah,
thanks
exactly.
a lot, number one.
Way to go, Riker. Way to go. But, so it was this captain's, like, dying wish, more or less. Like, it was more important, as Picard put it, it was more important to him to be able to communicate.
Right.
Or at least attempt to communicate, then his own life is not as important.
Right. And I think that it's a situation that is improved by the use or the presence of Captain Picard, because this episode is kind of a flip on the original series episode Arena, where Kirk and a lizard man, from the species called the Gorn,
sure.
have to fight. They're being forced to fight by this omnipotent third-party alien.
Sure.
And Kirk realizes that they're being tested, that they are being encouraged to submit to their, barbaric ancestral impulses.
Sure.
And he, of course, after making a cannon out of just spare things lying around the canyon and almost
as you do.
Blowing the Gorn's head off, he realizes, no, I won't fight for you! And he realizes what they're doing, and then they're like, oh, okay, well, you passed the test. I'm like, all right, fine. This
after
is kind of like that.
He killed the Gorn.
Yeah, immediately, Paul Winfield offers him a dagger, not because he wants them to fight, but Picard doesn't know that.
Yeah.
And Picard won't even take the dagger. He's like, no, I won't. I don't want the dagger.
Right.
And it takes like 15, 20 minutes before he hears the howl of some strange creature over the ridge where he's like, okay, yeah, I'll take the dagger.
Yeah, <We'll do> exactly.
Yeah, but these people they're trying to communicate with only talk in metaphor.
Uh-huh.
And in sort of reference to events from their culture.
And myths.
Like people on the internet.
Yeah. Wow.
They're meme talkers.
Sure.
They're meme talkers.
Yeah, okay.
And so what I thought was a really interesting thing, because it isn't just, oh, the Universal Translator's broke, so we can't talk to these guys, or they're so complicated that we can't even use the Universal
translator. Right.
We can understand the words just fine. It's just their patterns of thinking that the translator can't compensate for. And so we have to, both literally and figuratively, change our way of thinking and how we want to relate to these people. And I didn't start this off as a metaphor for what we're going through right now in our country, but I think it lines up pretty good.
It does. I actually was also reminded of Drax, but like in a, you know, opposite way, because sure. he doesn't get metaphors, you know?
Right.
So like something like if he ever met these people.
He's the absolute, yeah, they would just kill each other.
He would have no idea and he would just get so frustrated.
Yes.
Nothing goes over my head.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's a great script and a great idea by Joe Manosky, who joined the show, I think, season before, and he is writing on Discovery now too.
Oh, okay.
But it's just a real, from what I understand from him, like it's a real cerebral kind of script.
Yeah.
And he often delivers things like that. For good or ill, a lot of people would say that Masks from TNG not that great. And he wrote like 24 Voyager episodes.
Sure.
And some good ones, too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, he's a good guy to have on the staff there. But I just thought it's interesting, like, if we were going to do that now, it would just be Pepe, a single tier, you know, or Cheap Trick at Budokan.
Yeah.
So something like that. Well, see, that was painless. We got that out of the way.
Yeah.
Talking about Star Trek. Ooh. We can talk about other stuff now on the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Ikan Hana.
And we are back. Let's get done with this fast. Not because I want to be somewhere else, but I don't want to waste anybody's time. I don't think we have to go on forever about a lot of stuff. We'll do a little news and we'll talk about what's going on. There are a lot of interesting, kind of funky, strange stories that are happening. I don't think there's any real trends. Every week we do this, twice a week generally, and so I don't think of myself as a tea leaf reader or any kind of prognosticator, but you kind of see the way that things are going and the trends that are happening, and they're hard to read right now. The leaves are scattered. 8-Ball says, cloudy, ask again later.
Right.
And so I'm interested or excited to report on some of these kind of weird stories that we'll get to in a little bit. We want to talk about a pair of trailers, too, that have come out that are kind of a big deal recently that represent movies that will be coming up that I think people are pretty excited about. One of them is the Ghost in the Shell trailer, which we've talked about on the show before. We've seen the first trailer from the film now, and we have a few things to say about it. And as another surprise, we're going to talk about the Valerian City of a Thousand Planets trailer.
Yes.
The new epic film by Luc Besson.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the creator of, not just Fifth Element, I guess we'll say, but a ton of other stuff.
Yeah.
And a loser of a lawsuit against John Carpenter. So
moving on.
He got permission for this one, though, I'm pretty sure. And then, of course, at the end of the show, it's our beginning of the week show. We're doing our Craft to Services segment where we are going to talk about a film, which, and November is sort of officially, unofficially, we are focusing on the idea of storytelling.
Yeah.
Writers and creators. And, of course, when you talk about writers and creators and movies about them, you're going to get meta a lot of the time.
Yes.
And this is, we take the meta pill this week as we review Delirious, John Candy's movie from 1991
mm-hmm.
that I think I had to convince you existed. And I think a lot of our listeners / viewers will not know this movie, so we can introduce them to it.
Yeah, I was not aware of it before. And I mean, I was alive when it came out, but...
Yeah. So there you go. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Cal. A little tired, but doing well. How about you?
Yeah, same.
Yep.
Are we good?
Yeah, I'm
all
good.
Right, let's move on. Talk about the news. Told you this would be a shorter show. A lot of the news these days, whether it has to do with film, books, popular, you know, sci-fi fantasy books, comic books, even video games, they're all sort of the same story.
Okay.
Because it's usually one of those things being adapted into a film.
Yeah,
even
that seems
a film
to be the way it's
being
going.
Rebooted into a new film.
Sure.
And so a few of our stories are related to that. One thing that really caught my eye is that Jessica Chastain, who we all were just assaulted with for years, it seems like, assaulted pleasantly, but she was definitely...
she was in everything.
She was in your inbox, whether you subscribed or not.
Yeah.
She, at Tanagra, I think I'd do good in the Metaphor Society,
to
be honest.
I think you would do well.
She's been conspicuously absent from any of the comic book films that have plagued everybody's slate and audition schedules, I'm sure.
Yep.
And I'm not sure why that was, but that is about to change, because she is set to star in and produce a movie based on the Painkiller Jane comic book. That was a comic book from the 90s. by Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti, a longtime duo. It features a character named Painkiller Jane, who is a cop, a New York cop, who is killed in an accident, or basically killed in an accident, but learns that she has Wolverine-like healing powers.
Okay.
And so she decides to go after the, you know, mobsters and corrupt cops and stuff like that that ruined her life, because now she's got no way to die, but nothing to live for. That's her tagline.
So it's like a revenge story.
Yes.
Okay.
She has red hair.
So of course she has.
Perfect, I guess.
Okay, I've never heard of this character before. I'm going to be completely honest.
Never made much of a splash. Okay. If you bought comics in the 90s, you might have read it. It was definitely one
Did
of those
you read
that
it, Cal?
You. I've actually never read it, no.
Okay.
Because I felt like I got it. You know, I felt like I saw the cover.
Uh huh.
Oh, she's got a gun. Okay.
Yep.
Now, Painkiller, does she? Oh, she does. She experiences pain, but she doesn't. She can't die.
Uh huh.
Okay. Yep. Yep. I got 27 X books. I gotta clear here at the register, and so maybe I'll borrow it from a friend. But yeah, I never really got around to reading it.
Huh.
I'll tell you though that Quesada, before he now he is of course, what is he even CEO?
I have no idea.
No, he's not CEO. That's executive. He's like a president.
He's
of
up there.
Creative or whatever.
Right.
Chief editor or whatever of Marvel Comics. I think that's a good spot for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he's a guy. He's created a couple things when he used to be, you know, in the rank and file that were all fine, but not great.
Right.
And so I think that he has proved to be a much better
producer.
Editor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sort of a leader of men than a creator.
Sure.
And this is something, I mean, I don't think that he's going to write the script or anything like that. As far as I know, I think they're just going to pass it off to Lotus Entertainment. That's the company who is creating it and producing it. I've not really familiar with them, but I know that they in the past did the Z for Zachariah film.
Okay.
And a few other kind of smaller films. So, hey, even Lionsgate started from a tiny seed, I'm sure.
Sure.
Yeah. It's funny, though, that Palmiotti is repped by Lotus Management, which I can only assume is an affiliate of Lotus Entertainment.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. So this is all going to be, this is a vanity project. This is all in-house.
Yeah. Kind of interesting, though, that like Chastain would be like, this is the one. This one right here.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I lost the Captain Marvel bit and I'm like, screw you. I'm going to make my own comic book movie.
Right, right.
And since I don't know anything about comics, what's a good one?
Yeah.
Painkiller Jane? That sounds good. Let's do it.
Yeah. That's kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah.
I just think she could have held out for more. I mean, it's not a Marvel property, right?
Right.
So she could do something else somewhere else down the line. But
yes. Yes.
Yeah.
In further comic book, female comic book hero news, the Harley Quinn / Birds of Prey spinoff movie has found a writer.
Okay, who's
it was
the
announced,
writer?
Announced that Margot Robbie, in her success, just as being Margot Robbie, living life on God mode, she was, you know, they're going to spin off Harley Quinn from Suicide Squad because everybody loves Harley,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to star in and produce the film. And so the screenwriter that they've gotten is Christina Hodson. She is somebody who has been pretty hot recently. She had a couple scripts on The Blacklist.
Okay.
On The Blacklist, I think you know, but for anybody who doesn't know, is sort of an unofficial list of scripts going around Hollywood that people
hasn't
love.
Found a
Everybody's
buyer
read.
Yet.
Everybody loves them, but nobody wants to make them for whatever reason. Maybe
okay.
they're just too ambitious. Maybe they're too, you know, you can't understand them, or you think that audiences won't.
Or they don't
They're
feel
generally
like...
thought of as, because there's a billion unproduced scripts, but
sure.
they have this list because it's this represents that line between what's really good and what we think we can get the American public to swallow.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have a list for you now, but I'm sure I could compile a list, or you can look it up on Wikipedia, of films that were on the blacklist.
And then eventually
and
they
finally
got
made. And people are like, oh, this is so great.
Right.
And so whenever people always kind of cheer when scripts make it off that list, she had a spec script called The Eden Project that did actually get a deal with Sony and is being produced.
Okay.
She also is writing the Fugitive reboot.
Oh boy. Like
for Warner Brothers.
Like we need to reboot that.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Yeah, and she's pretty much in the Warner Brothers stable. She's written the Bumblebee spinoff movie as well from the Transformers franchise.
Okay.
So, busy person.
All right.
Warner Brothers has a lot of faith in her, and so seems like a good sign for the Harley Quinn movie.
Yeah. That sounds exciting. Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad they got a female writer to write the script. I mean, I know they're probably aiming for that, but it's good to
I'm
see.
Amazed they got a female writer to write a Transformers movie.
Yeah.
Seems like there's a lot of crunching the juice extreme style in that writer's room.
Yeah, I know, right?
Although they did form that like writer's room for the franchise in general. And like, who is Lindelof or somebody in there?
I don't know.
I can't remember. But anyway, they announced that they, you know, in order to make a Avengers-like franchise
brand for Transformers,
they assembled a group of like 12 people to be like a writer's room, like just for Transformers projects. So whatever.
Probably just to make sure that like none of the stories contradict one another.
Oh yeah, they're all so contradictory.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hey, we had King Arthur in the last one. I still think his crown is gonna transform.
Right. I mean, why else would he be there? It's just so ridiculous.
I honestly think, I like that.
Yeah.
Or like somebody turns into his sword. Yeah, there's a new Autobot called Excalibur that becomes his sword.
Yeah.
I honestly think that it's just a computer. They just feed things into a computer and little cards come out. And this card said, usually it says, robot balls, you know, or like racist Transformers. This time it said King Arthur and they're like, get it done. Let's do it.
You know what it reminds me of was like, I don't know if it was a College Humor skit or what, but like back when Lost was still on TV.
Yeah.
And they had all these ideas and they had a turtle going to pick out which one the other.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of a different skit, but yeah, that's a.
Yes.
Yeah. I can see that one too.
Yeah. It's so ridiculous, but that show was so random that like it did seem like it was that arbitrary.
Yeah, I guess if you are reading a lot of the same books or had read a lot of the same books and seen the movies that the people that created the show did,
uh-huh.
you could kind of see the strings. You could kind of understand why the show went in certain places. My thing was, at some point you have to rein in all that excited homage and creativity and like actually tell a story.
And
they kind of forgot
home.
To do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking about telling stories, here's a story for you. You know Frank Cho?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
One of our favorites on the show.
Yes. He has revealed that he has a Wonder Woman series in negotiation at DC.
Oh, come on. I don't want him drawing Wonder Woman because there's going to just be all these butt shots and stuff like that.
Yes. Well, if only butt shots. And he is apparently waiting for Greg Rucka to... who's currently writing Wonder Woman to finish up, and then he'll be doing it for DC.
Dear Greg Rucka, please continue writing Wonder Woman forever. Thank you.
Here's the second half of the story.
Uh-oh.
DC says, we don't know what he's talking about.
A
DC Comics spokesperson responded to the CBR article where I got this information and said that there are no current plans for a Wonder Woman project by Mr. Cho.
What the heck? Why would he say that if it wasn't true? Is he just trying to get it to happen? So he's trying to start a rumor or something? I don't understand. I don't understand at all.
I'm working on a theory called like the Batman theory of being cool.
Okay.
Batman is, by all appearances, the coolest superhero ever.
Right.
But when you think about what he has to do, like think about the scene in Batman Begins. It's the first time that we see him really in action. It's when he is stalking all the guys in the shipping yard or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it ends with him pulling Tom Wilkinson out of the car. And I'm Batman. Nice coat. What? Do I undercut your scene? Anyway,
I don't know.
You're really scary up to that point. And he's tracking down and like eliminating one by one, like half a dozen guys with machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
Until he finally gets the last guy, like, is terrified, is peeing his pants, and backs into him, and he's hanging upside down. Awesome, right?
Right.
Think about, but we see it from the bad guy's point of view. I always said that, like, a good Batman scene or a good Batman movie is, it's a monster movie where Batman is the monster.
Right.
Right? And so we should stay with the sexy teens who are getting picked off one by one, and he should be terrifying when he's not Bruce Wayne.
Right.
And that scene does that pretty well. But practically, if you think about all the things that Batman would have had to do in order to set up, you know, he's got to set a booby trap here. He's got to make sure this line is there. He got there at noon.
Yeah.
You know, for this drug deal that was going on at 10 p.m.
Like, right.
And he had to set. And there was probably like once the cops show up, take Tom Wilkinson away and all the other guys, there's probably other snares and traps, yes, and things that he left that the bad guys never went into, contingencies. So he's going to like, he's got a big sack.
He's
shoving all these bombs and smoke bombs and traps into his sack. Takes the sack. He's got to walk home. If you saw him doing that, he would look ridiculous.
Yes.
But as long as you don't see him,
yes,
he's cool.
Exactly.
So if being cool is not trying at all, there are so many people who try so hard to be cool.
Yes.
And when you see that guy with this infinity scarf on and his light up vape pen and he's walking down the street and he looks so cool in those skinny jeans, if you saw him browsing Amazon or Bonobos .com for those pants for 3 hours, you'd be like, you nerd.
Yeah.
You freaking nerd.
Yeah, exactly. You're trying too hard.
That's the Frank Cho thing.
Yeah.
He thinks he's so cool.
He thinks he's so cool.
Nobody can catch him, and he's the bad boy of comics. And then he's like, oh, yeah, this is totally happening. Somebody called this bluff. And now he's like, we're working on it. Quick butt. Shh. He just sketches a butt. And then disappears. Everybody's like, oh, this is a butt.
That's very Frank Cho.
So anyway, a show that we know is being developed but actually is being pushed back is the Cloak and Dagger series.
Okay, why is it being pushed back?
Well, because I don't think they're quite ready to get it rolling just yet. It was initially planned for a 2017 release. I believe that we did actually talk about this previously on the show. It is going to be on Freeform, the channel it was formerly known as ABC Family.
Oh, why is it Freeform? That seems like a really weird name. I'm sorry. I'm judging hard.
Not sure why it's Freeform. I do know that they are putting it on there at Disney, ABC Disney, probably because they don't want to take up any slots on their actual network.
Sure.
Because they canceled Agent Carter.
Yep.
Agent Carter's new show, Conviction, was canceled.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, it's all gone. So this guy named Joe Pekaske, who is a writer on Heroes, is the writer of the pilot, and he's also the showrunner, and it is being pushed back to 2018. No more information than that right now. As far as Freeform goes, they have shows like Pretty Little Liars and Switched at Birth and that sort of thing. So they are aiming to make this a YA experience.
So,
because you think ABC Family, you think hard PG.
Right.
Hard PG.
Yeah, they're trying to make this a PG-13.
Ask me what Cloak and Dagger is about. Cloak and Dagger is about two runaways who get hooked on magic heroin that gives them mutant powers, and then they decide that they're going to go around and like take out drug dealers, and you know, they're a war on drugs kind of.
That doesn't sound like a family show.
No,
I'm just saying.
It is not.
Okay. All right, kids.
Not really at all. And it comes from a weird. They're created by Bill Mantlo, as we talked about last show. And it comes from a weird time because a lot of things were going dark in the 80s, even, you know, because of Frank Miller and Alan Moore and all that stuff. But even things that are clearly marketed for children, I do believe that they were originally supposed to be, like, for kids.
Sure.
But what I described is dark.
It's very dark.
And Cloak, he has this ability to send, he is essentially a living cloak of darkness, and he can send people into the cloak, and they experience like existential like pain and dark, and
that's
they sort of
feel
the darkness in their own soul, you know, and so they're left like,
kids.
Yeah, even Power Pack, a literal team of children that was for children, went to some really dark places. Like, their comics were dark, man.
Yeah,
they're fighting like drug dealers all the time.
Well, I feel like the 80s,
everything was drug dealers.
I feel like the 80s, and I mean, I think this trend kind of started in like the 70s, but like, I feel like a lot of the stuff that was going on was in the real world was pretty dark, and so I think comics ended up reflecting that. It was like all of a sudden we're not so much in the hippie era, and like all we need is peace and love, and you know, now we're hearing more about these people who are, you know, killing kids, and you know, it's not safe for your kid to walk alone to school anymore and that sort of thing, and people just get terrified.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the comics that will be created in the next couple of years.
Ugh.
Take off that infinity scarf. pick up that smack kit.
No.
And that assault rifle, and let's start reading. One more little story before we take off here. It turns out that
Hayao Miyazaki.
Hayao, that's it? Like Ohio?
Like Hayao Miyazaki, yeah.
Hayao Miyazaki, who is the founder of Studio Ghibli, and name some of his films.
He did My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Spirited Away, and Princess Mononoke, yeah.
Yeah, he is retired, famously, from anime, but he wants to come back.
Yes.
For one last ride.
Yeah.
He is working on a CG animated short called Boro the Caterpillar, which is for the Ghibli Museum, but he wants to, or he's made a proposal to develop it as a full-length feature.
Yeah.
And at this point, even if you're like the boss emeritus, seems like they're going to say yes.
I think they probably will.
Yeah.
I think it would be dumb to not say yes. I mean, his son is still one of the big directors at Studio Ghibli. So,
yes.
I mean, he, even if he is quote-unquote retired, I think he still has somewhat of say in like the overall dealings, I feel like, in the company.
Yes.
So
I think that he is trying to aim, or at least he was suggesting that it could be targeted for the 2020 Olympic Games at Tokyo, sort of, I guess, like a tie-in, or just...
They're pretty excited
more,
about
yeah,
the games.
Just, you know, more Japanese culture that they're, you know, hoping to put on show when the Olympic Games are all in town. So, yeah, are you excited about this?
I am excited about this because, honestly, I'm excited about another Miyazaki film because I got to tell you, it was a little bittersweet when he retired, even though, I mean, he's getting up there. It's not like he's a, you know, and I understand why he wants to retire because he probably works really, really hard on these films and he deserves his time off. But no, I am definitely excited about it. I love his films, and I think he has a wonderful imagination, and he really brings a lot to these anime.
I'm excited, too, although I think on his way out, he had some very choice words to say about anime.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons he quit beyond his age is that he is very disillusioned with what it's become. In fact, I think that he would hate, and probably did hate, Ghost in the Shell in any animated form.
You think so?
Yeah. I don't think, I can't see the major really fitting into any of his work.
No, I can't really either, so.
Except, who's the girl who protects the wolf that has the voice of Scully? Princess Mononoke.
Yes.
That's literally Princess Mononoke.
That's literally
nice
Princess
work, Cal.
Mononoke.
Yeah. I think you could take Princess Mononoke out and stick Motoko Kusanagi in there and you'd probably have the same movie.
More or less.
Only she has to fall in love with the dude at the end.
Yeah.
Because of course she does.
Mm. Kind of.
Bring it on back, Miyazaki-san.
Wow.
Hopefully something original. Well, we already started talking about it before, so let's keep going. Let's talk about the Ghost in the Shell trailer. 2017 comes out March 31st, 2017. So that is pretty much right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And it is based, I mean, I don't know how people don't know, but we got to do our due diligence. It's based on a manga, which came out late 80s, early 90s.
Right.
Although I think it's probably going to be much more based on the 1995 anime version of the manga.
Probably.
About a woman named Motoko Kusanagi, although in this she's just named the Major, because they're not whitewashing. They're not whitewashing.
Right.
But anyway, she is a government operative for
something.
Government.
Yep.
I guess it's definitely not Japan's government.
I don't know.
And she is, she's like a James Bond meets Jack Bauer kind of figure. You know, she's a spy, an operative, a soldier. But what distinguishes her is that she is a complete cyborg, which is to say that she is a human brain in a fully robot body.
Yep.
And in this future of Neo Tokyo. No, that's Akira. They just live in plain old Tokyo. Maybe it is Neo Tokyo.
I'm not sure.
It's 2029, although I'm sure they're going to bump that up.
Probably.
For the movie. We're a little too close to that. Many people have what they call cyber bodies, and the idea that you have a real brain makes you human. If you don't have a brain, you're just a robot.
Right.
And so that is that sort of identity that you can cling to, that you have a soul, but even the idea of a soul in your mind has been reduced to what they call a ghost. like your digital pattern that is you is a ghost, which is where the title Ghost in the Shell comes from. And as she performs her duties for Section 9, the government organization that she works for, she begins to question her identity. And if she is just a brain, you know, is she still human, or is she somehow more or less than human? And then a lot of shooting, too. There's a lot of shooting.
Yes.
I feel like the film is probably going to feature a lot more shooting than the philosophical things that I was mentioning before. And we've seen this trailer. There's been famously during the finale of Mr. Robot, they released like these little 10-second blips from the film, which I guess was supposed to be some kind of synergistic marketing thing. Like, oh, it's like you're seeing part of a decoded transmission from the cyber tube.
It was definitely a tease. Like, if you want to know what a teaser trailer, that's... They were all
teasers. Well, now the actual teaser trailer is out. Still don't understand how that works.
Nope. Whatever.
For this film, which is directed by Rupert Sanders, director of Snow White and the Huntsman. Yeah. Starring, of course, Scarlett Johansson in the role of the major. Other stars in the film include Michael Pitt, Juliette Binoche is in it, and Michael Wincott is in it as well.
Beat Takeshi.
And, of course, Beat Takeshi. I'll tell you one thing. If you like breaking glass, you're in luck. This is the film for you.
It's very reminiscent of Blade Runner, I feel like.
I don't think that... you can't get away from that.
I'm sorry. It looks like the shots of the city with the lights and everything.
And especially updating it from jumbo screen TVs to now holograms. But they've definitely taken that idea where... And that's something that they kind of had in the Mamoru Oshii's... film version from 95, his anime, which is still considered to be one of the best anime films of all time.
Yeah.
So these are gigantic shoes that you may or may not be able to fill, cyber body or no, but they're definitely not trying to distance themselves from those influences.
Oh, no.
And
not at all.
What I find really ironic is, so there's this scene that starts the Ghost in the Shell manga, the Ghost in the Shell film, the Ghost in the Shell TV show, every single iteration has featured this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about two helicopters flying, because that's not really in the comic book, but it is in the film. And everybody seems to think that that scene encapsulates so much of what we think of as Ghost in the Shell, which is the Major. I'm just going to use their terminology. The Major is on top of this building. There's an incident going on inside the building. She jumps off the building in this like skin-tight, you know, suit, like her operations suit or whatever. She blows through a window, kills a bunch of guys, and then she sort of disappears at the end because we find out that this suit is like chameleon predator camouflage called like OptoCam.
Sure.
And that's her sort of trademark. She's invisible a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So we see that. We see a scene that is taken directly from the anime as well, where she is fighting this guy in some water.
Yep. And she's kind of visible and then not visible.
Right, exactly.
Again, with a suit.
So we've seen that. We've seen a scene where it looks like she and Bateau, one of her partners in Section 9, are on a boat, which, don't you ever forget, which is direct from the anime as well, not even from the book. And so, yeah, I kind of feel like the movie's only like maybe 75, 80 minutes long. I feel like they're just going to cut the fat out of the anime, and then they're going to add their own story that they've talked about.
Okay. I mean, that might be all right. I don't know. Here's the thing. Okay, I think it looks cool. I'm not sure how well they're going to tell the story. I think that Scarlett Johansson is doing a great job as the Major. I think she's kicking a lot of butt. But this is another film that I'm just cautiously optimistic for, because I just don't know if they're gonna really get it. And I mean, I guess when I'm trying to say is like that they're gonna pay homage in the way that the fans feel like they should to the story, even if they don't get it exactly right, even if they are doing a different story.
I've said before in little snatches what I'm about to say, but I'm just gonna say it now because we're talking about the film now, talking about the trailer, which is that this is not an American story. It was a mistake to whitewash it. It might actually be a mistake to try to make it a film for American audiences. Recently, and we didn't report this on the show, the writer of the Sandman movie walked off the project. Mm-hmm. He's the third writer they've lost, and he penned a letter specifically to anybody who was interested to say, this is not a TV or movie. This needs to be a TV show.
And I 100% agree with him.
And I'm not sure that this is an American action movie. if you read the comic, and they did a lot in the anime to make it more of a narrative, a filmic narrative, but even then it sort of falls down. There is something about manga, its episodic nature, and also I think the nature of the type of story that an Eastern audience wants to hear or is willing to hear as compared to a Western audience. Mm-hmm. There is not a lot of cohesion to the story in the manga. What you think of as the first, I think it's like 11 issues or 12 issues perhaps, of the graphic novel, of the collection of issues that is the Ghost in the Shell source material.
Yep.
And it goes all over the place. Like, it follows different people, different stuff. It's very political. And it follows Motoko insofar as she's our protagonist, but we learn next to nothing about her as a character.
Right.
It isn't important. It's mysterious. But it's really the film that introduced this idea of her lack of identity. In fact, in the books, she doesn't question her identity. There's an event that makes her question her identity, and that leads almost directly to the very end of the book, and then something else.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sequel that was penned like, you know, 10 years later that's very different from the original material, which will probably never get turned. If this becomes a franchise, I don't think they're going to draw from that because it's almost unrecognizable as Ghost in the Shell. And so they want to make it. We've seen in the trailer, it's like, you're the first of your kind.
Right.
And she's like, I don't know where I come from, but I'm going to find out. And the bad guy's like, what if I told you that everything they told you isn't true?
Right.
None of that has ever been a part of the character.
Mm-hmm.
As a character in the manga, she is somebody who should be freaking out because her life is crazy. Like, she is killing people all the time, you know, as she, her body blows up, they stick her in another one. She's supposed to be just fine with that.
Right.
And as a character, she kind of is. You get the impression that she lives her life, like, she works hard, but she plays hard, and she lives her life like no tomorrow because she's Miss Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Right.
But there isn't this, like, and then we see Bond have 8 martinis on the plane and he's all sad, you know, and he's trying to talk to the bartender and he's kind of a pathetic figure. We never have that. She just kind of like, eh, screw it. Like, she just lives her life.
She's a machine. She is a killing machine.
Yeah. And she's okay with that.
Questions it maybe a little bit, and maybe, but not to the extent the film is.
And maybe that's not deep enough to hang a 3-act structure in a film on. And so they change that from the manga, and they do introduce the idea of her feeling incomplete and questioning her situation. And then the final conflict that they finally get into is the sort of antagonist turns out to be maybe not so antagonizing, and he offers a way to change that, and she takes him up on it. Spoilers of the structure of the film, but I'm not telling you really what happens.
Right.
And so we get that. And that's tidy. That's pretty good. Maybe that's quote unquote fixing it. But I just think that they're going to just go hard over into our Western idea of what we want out of our protagonist, which is like, especially nowadays, you know, it's like a Tom Cruise movie. Like, he had the perfect life until he found out something was wrong.
Right.
But now he's going to... That's just kind of what it seems like they're going to do.
And
also the rumors that they are going to integrate the one story from the Ghost in the Shell TV show. Mm-hmm. Not the new one, Arise, but the standalone action guys, man.
With her as a little kid.
Yeah. Well, the story that is ostensibly about her and how she became a cyborg in the first place and her mm-hmm. sort of hidden story of being a child cyborg.
Right.
They're just going to jam all that in there. And nobody asked for it. That stuff that's in like the show Bible that you use as character motivation, but it never ends up like on the page or on the screen.
Sure. It can be suggested.
Yeah, they're just going to take that. It's like going to Lucas's Journal of the Wills and going, let's use some of this stuff for the prequels or something. It's like, no. Let's just, where's Luke now? Let's just do that.
Yeah, right.
That said, looks amazing. I mean, it really does look fantastic.
It does. It looks fantastic.
The one thing I don't like is her skin suit looks a little weird.
Her skin suit, I can't quite tell if she's wearing it or if she's just like a naked robot.
It doesn't really exist in the comic.
Okay.
In the movie, the anime, it's essentially, her skin is very white, mm-hmm. and it is also very white. And so it looks kind of like some kind of cover. Of course, Scarlett Johansson is rosy-cheeked and stuff like that. And I think maybe they wanted to still keep like the implication that she's nude.
Right.
Which I don't think is necessary, but they're going to take it the chance if they get it, right?
Right.
And so I think they've matched it to her tone, but it looks like she's just wearing like this rubber, you know, it looks like a fetish suit, basically.
It does. It's exactly what it looks like. So I don't know. I am cautiously optimistic that this is actually going to be good, and I'm hoping that maybe just maybe their departure from the source material will be a good move, but I'm not 100% sure. I mean, at least it won't be like Watchmen, like trying to do everything panel by panel.
Well, and
but maybe this is too much the other way.
Yeah, and well, and that's, I think we're already seeing that because there are panels, like I said, that are directly, they said, let's make a big action movie version of this.
Right.
And let's follow the tradition and do the opening scene that every iteration of this has done.
Right.
Maybe that's like the James Bond gun barrel camera. Maybe that's something you have to do. But my thing, and I'm glad you brought up Watchmen, is Watchmen was also visually impressive.
It was. But
it showed that it completely misapprehended what the entire
book was
point
about.
Was about.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid they're going to do that with this too. Because it's not about this little girl who's trying to rectify something with her past and like
and figure
find out
self-identity.
The truth and they lied to her or something. No, I mean, it can be about identity. Because if you take the manga and you take the comic and you sort of, or that's the same thing, the manga and the anime, and you try to put them together, you are faced with a woman who lacks identity, and she's either bothered by that or she isn't.
Mm-hmm.
She's either bothered by it and lives and acts in a way that she's trying to not let it overtake her, or she is contemplating it. They say in the comic that, and they say in the movie or the trailer, you're the first of, you're one of a kind. She's not. The whole point of her body is that, sure, it has military hardware inside of it. Like, it's not the standard off the rack kind of cyborg body you could get if you were shopping in Neo Tokyo.
Sure.
But its face, like its design specs, are very similar. It's they make several comments about how it's just an off the line sort of model.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and then they never dive into that because Masamune Shiro's not. He likes guns and butts, and that's all he wants to get into. And so he never really explores that. But the movie takes the chance to explore that, because why would somebody who could pick any face they want, like she could have them sculpt a particular face.
Yeah.
Why would she pick a face that she could run into in the street?
Yeah.
You know, that would be like anybody else's. It's mm-hmm. like getting a Samsung Galaxy Note. Like, everybody's got them.
Right.
So, and they play with that in the film. Like, while she's sort of soul searching, she looks up and sees another person, like in a cafe, who's got her face, and she's like, whoa, I'm a little freaked out right now.
Right.
Because I was thinking about, like, am I a unique person?
Right.
You know, what makes me unique?
Right.
And so that speaks a lot to the character, but instead it's like, you can do it. You're the one. There's something special about you.
Yeah, which is just kind of
no,
boring.
You have to prove that there's something special about you.
Yeah.
You weren't special because people tell you you are.
Right.
That's what happens to a child. What a great drawing of an elephant. It's like, it's just a gray squiggle. Oh, honey. You're an artist. And as far as the movie being whitewashed, which has been all over the news, I mean, how do you feel about that?
It's frustrating. It's hard because they've been trying to make... It's complicated. They've been trying to make this film for a really long time, and they felt like they couldn't get it made without having a big star
in the
lead
role.
That's
true of a lot of things.
And I think that Scarlett Johansson is doing a great job. There is a part of me that does kind of wish it was like a Japanese, you know, like the whole movie was Japanese actors, you know, and there's a part of me that's,
the whole movie?
Well, you know, like the leads, you know, and there's a part of me that's like, is it going to be as good? Or like, I mean, where are they setting it? I don't even know where they're setting it. Like, is this Tokyo?
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know.
So I don't know. There is a little bit that's like, it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Well, I think you, like you mentioned, you know, you need to have a star in this to get it made. Alex Proyas said the same thing. I mean, he's a Greek Egyptian who grew up in Australia,
yeah.
And he made Gods of Egypt.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I cast the guy from Game of Thrones because this thing's got to get made. Like,
yeah.
It's not going to get made if I put Alexander Siddig in it or something like that.
Right.
And so the implication from directors like him, the comments by Rupert Sanders, essentially, you know, along the same line, is that it's the audience's fault because we don't like,
which is...
we haven't accepted those people as main characters or as big stars. And so their hands are tied when they cast. And my thing is like, it can't be both.
I think it
I don't
is
disagree,
both.
But
yeah.
Why did you completely stack this thing with white dudes?
And beat Takeshi.
Yeah. Here's a great example. And then even have, you could even say, I mean, they're cyborgs. So you could even say that the major whose name Japanese name you have erased, and now she's just the major. You could say that she began as a Japanese, like if we say a flashback of her, she could be a little Japanese girl whose body is destroyed in a plane crash or whatever
and
it is.
And she happens to be put into this
a series of bodies. But right now she's in this body, which, and it could be kind of an in-joke, is based on, it's very beautiful, it's based on like a famous, you know, international movie star. So she has like a stock Scarlett Johansson body that you might see in other places.
Sure.
And to her, it doesn't matter. It's part of the lack of identity that she suffers from is that, she has a white body, but she is a Japanese person. And it's so cheesy. You could get away with it if you did that.
Yeah.
But instead, he's just like, look, it's an international cast.
I
mean, don't get me wrong. You look at her team, and this has been developed in like the TV show version where she has this team that does seem like they're all different guys. Like her Bateau is this huge blonde guy, like Dolph Lundgren, you know, would be perfect casting for him.
Right.
Okay, fine. You got the big Slavic guy. You've got another guy that's got a beard and looks like he's like darker complected. You've got another guy who's like clearly like an Asian guy.
Yeah.
Or is it Boma? One of them is like bald.
Mm-hmm.
He looks Asian, but he's very bald and pale, like maybe he's albino Asian or something.
Sure.
So all of this is open to you if you decide to take advantage of it. We'll definitely see.
Yes.
Something else that we're going to have to see about is the trailer that we saw for Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets.
Yes.
Valerian, huh?
Yeah.
That's what you're going with.
I don't know that much about.
You can chew it if you're having trouble sleeping.
Right. Kind of scenes like that.
Pretty much. It is a film by Luc Besson that is coming out July 21st, 2017. We remarked that it was a little weird that GT or GITS, as they abbreviate it, was coming out March 31st. And I'd say, no, that is them
being smart.
Yeah, I think April is now summer in movie terms. So that is them on the very cusp of summer, staying away from the minefield that is the summer comic book movie season.
Right, but Ghost in the Shell, I feel like, has more name recognition than Valerian and the City of 1,000
but
Planets.
But that's my thing. Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets. Luc Besson, he is the biggest swinging, however you say dick in French, there ever was. He is Mr. Fifth Element. He's never had anything else that's been a success that you could think of. And it was his dream to make this. In fact, there's a reason that this looks like Fifth Element is because he grew up reading Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't always called that. I mean, it's based on, they say it's based on a graphic novel, but it's really based on, it's not really a strip, but it's like an ongoing sort of comic story.
Okay.
Called Valerian and Laureline.
Okay.
Which is about Valerian and Laureline. They're like space cops, basically.
Sure.
And he's like your titular, you know, hero, and he like wants to get with her, and she's always like, no, you know, leave me alone. And we see this in the trailer, this kind of push pull between Cole Dahan and two weird named protagonists, Cara Delevingne.
Yeah, I know. Like their actual weird names and then their character weird names.
Yeah, their actual names are weirder than their character names. And so, I mean, he definitely was trying to make this when he was making Fifth Element.
Yeah.
And so now he actually gets to make this. And I think you're going to see a lot of his love. It's not Cole Dahan, it's Dane Dahan, in this. And I think that's a danger, too.
You think so?
Yes.
Okay.
Because he's already, long ago, I think he went into like Lucas territory, where nobody tells him no. He's still incredibly inventive. But he has an idea like, what if the brain used 100%? And we got Lucy.
Oh my gosh, don't remind me about Lucy.
I bet he almost definitely wanted ScarJo to be in this, don't you think? I bet he tried as hard as he could to get her in this.
Yeah, but she was busy.
And said she's going to be in the film that's going to kill this.
Yeah.
Or we'll see. But anyway, it takes place in the 28th century, and Valerian and Laureline are space cops, like I said. They're special operatives that work for the space government, and they go around, they deal with aliens, and there's a lot of explosions and neon lights.
Yeah, and kicking. And
we don't really know much other than that.
It looks cool. That's about all I can say. I mean, it looks really cool.
Yeah. They also travel in time, too. I think I forgot to mention that.
That's not clear.
That is an element.
But you know what I think is interesting is the two leads in this, I feel like they kind of both have kind of a weird alien look about them.
Yeah, they are very distinctive looking.
And they almost look like they could be related in a weird sort of way. I don't know, maybe it's the eyebrows. And I feel weird saying that because what does that even mean?
Hashtag French don't care.
Yeah. And I really hope that Luc Besson was able to direct Cara Delevingne in a way that she comes across
Look, she hasn't been in a lot of movies. She's going to get better. I wish we didn't have to watch her get better, though.
The Suicide Squad was a little painful.
Yeah, it was
and
not good.
I didn't want it to be painful. I was rooting for her.
I hope that I get a press pass to see this because I don't want to pay for this. I haven't liked a Luc Besson movie since Leon, so that takes you back a little ways.
Wow.
This looks like. Sure, it's okay. What do we say about bad movies? Not today, but what do we also say? Oh, they're visually amazing.
Well, I think we just said that about Ghost in the Shell
and
too.
Doctor Strange. Yeah. I think that this will be visually amazing, but I think it will be completely disappointing in every other way. And here's why: I don't get the French sense of humor, or if they have one. This is totally written. Cinematography, the story, you know, I'm sure Besson has got his name on the top of the script, but
probably.
He was helped by other collaborators.
Yes.
And there was just, we talked about what you expect out of a Western film.
Right.
With the character arc, the three-act structure. I think the French don't care about that a lot of the time. They'll just put some interesting sort of weird things out there. The character will bounce from sort of set piece to set piece. You see this in other films. Like, I think produced this, but I don't think he wrote it, but The Adventures of Adele Blanksek.
Okay, yeah.
Remember that we saw that about the sort of female-ish
Indiana Jones figure, which is also based on a
comic book.
Yes.
But it's just a bunch of things that happen and a bunch of jokes that are kind of like based in like race and class distinction and prejudice for you to really get them.
Yeah.
And I'm really worried about that. I'm worried about seeing Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne fight a bunch of tribal aliens with spears and feathers.
Yep.
You just don't get it. France, do you? You don't.
I know. He wrote the screenplay for Adele Blanksek, but he also wrote the screenplay for Taken and Taken 2.
Oh yeah, produced it. That's where he got the money to make this.
Yeah, yeah. And I freaking love Taken and Taken 2.
Yeah,
but
French don't give a merit. They don't. So I hope that it, I mean, you've got Clive Owen's also in it. Ethan Hawke is in it.
I knew Clive Owen was in it.
So, yeah, but I think that he'll just be like the Eddie Redmayne in Jupiter Ascending. Like, why are you in this?
I was just reading a little bit, and apparently Clive Owen's supposed to be their boss or something.
Okay.
So,
well,
I mean, it might just be a bit
I'm expecting
part.
A heel turn. But, I'm not expecting much from this. Luc Besson.
Oh, Rihanna is also in it.
Yeah, Rihanna's in it for some reason.
Oh, her character name, by the way, Rihanna's character name, you know what it is? Bubble. Yep. So there's a little fun fact for you.
Well, at least there's a black woman in the movie.
Stop.
At least there's a black woman in the movie. Name three John Candy movies that aren't Delirious.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Uncle Buck. Help me out here.
No, I can't. I don't see your name.
No.
Computer's down.
No. I'm freaking out. I know more John Candy movies than this.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the ride. Look up, man. It's bobsled time.
Oh, was he in
Still
Cool what, Cool Running?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he was.
Okay.
So it's kind of a generational thing, I think.
Yeah.
When you die at 43 in 1994.
43?
Yeah.
94. So yeah. 3 years after this movie came out.
Yes. Well, it was sudden. I mean, it's not like he planned it.
Yeah, I know he died young.
Yes.
But,
And I think that it's sometimes, and for some reason, you know, here's the reason. There are other stars who died early and yet like Patrick Swayze, like we still are watching in his movies and talking about them.
Yes.
Because he at least survived to a point of this sort of world of criticism and like spilling lots of digital ink about the things that we saw growing up.
Right.
The blogging generation grew up when he was making movies, and so now we're returning this to you. But right. John missed the cutoff. He died before a period, I think, where people would really... I mean, you don't see a lot of people talking about The Great Outdoors. And then he was also sadly cursed with the fact that a lot of the movies he was in weren't that good.
Yeah.
Like, Stripes, you know, good. I think Splash is memorable, if not like a great film. Spaceballs...
I love Spaceballs.
Yeah,
I was
people like
Spaceballs. Yeah.
But, like, that's nobody's talking about Summer Rental. Do you know what I mean?
No, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so he died at a point that pretty much, like, capped his legacy, like, right there.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to bring that back a little bit today, although I'm not sure how successful we'll be, with 1991's Delirious.
Yeah. Wow. That's quite the
Delirious
intro.
It is also, I think... It represents a Hollywood that died too early.
And yes!
Thank God. Thank God. We'll talk about it in a little bit. If you don't know, it is a film starring, of course, John Candy as Jack Gable. He is a writer and producer of a soap opera called Beyond Our Dreams.
Yeah, so cheesy.
Yes. And he is the writer. He contends with the other producers on the show. In this case, played by Jerry Orbach.
Yes.
Of course, dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
Yeah. And also character actress Renee Taylor. They play the Sherwoods, which must be a reference to Sherwood Schwartz of Gilligan's Island, another TV producing fame.
It must be.
And so he's getting in fights with them because they want to change up the show. As ridiculous as soap operas are, it seems like Jack has a real love for them, though, and he has an integrity.
Even though he hates it at the same time.
Yeah, they want to kill off a character with a brain tumor, and he's like, we already did a brain tumor. We did two brain tumors already.
Yeah.
So that's stupid, and so he is serious about his stupid job.
Yeah.
He is also in love with the head actress, lead actress, played by Laura Claiborne, who's played by Emma Sams.
Yes.
And he's protecting her. The producers want to get rid of her because she's a handful in her
she's
character as Rachel Hedison, on the show. And the show is set in Ashford Falls,
which is a fictional town.
Yes, of course it is. And it stars a lot of other funny people. David Rashke plays Dr. Paul Kirkwood on the show.
Yep.
You might remember him from Sledgehammer, the 80s program. No, of course you won't.
Uh-uh.
One might remember him. It features also Raymond Burr as Carter Hedison, the head of the sort of like evil Victor character, to use soap opera parlance. And Charles Rocket, another gone too soon person, plays Ty Hedison, the totally ridiculous character with an eye patch.
Yep.
He's got...
Twin Peaks, anyone?
only this is played not straight. Twin Peaks is like semi-straight.
Semi-not. Yeah, I know.
And he has,
what? You remember, right? It's, Amnesia.
Yeah. See, if you had done it, that would have been the bit.
Come on.
And there's a couple other people that you might recognize in here. Mark Boone Jr. plays the cable man.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the movie, he has also been in a couple other things. He's a character actor. He played Flass in Batman Begins.
Okay.
They're like, they don't like falafel? He's the dirty cop that Batman hangs upside down.
Okay,
he's
sure.
Got the wild hair, but this is before that. Zach Grenier is also in it. He is a character actor who's been on a ton of stuff.
I've seen him.
But
before.
You'll recognize him probably from Fight Club.
Oh, yeah.
A Fincher joint when he plays Jack's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Wagner is in this as Robert Wagner.
Yep.
He makes a sort of meta appearance. And Margot Kidder is in it as well, which I think is weird. Because, as we haven't mentioned, Mariel Hemingway plays the sort of ingenue character.
Yes.
She plays a character who shows up to audition for Beyond Our Dreams.
Yes.
And then ends up being in the show in a way later.
Yep.
And in the very beginning of the movie, she's in the bathroom getting ready for our audition. And Margot Kidder comes in and she's like... good luck out there, kid.
Yeah.
In this kind of like handoff, they also were in Superman 4 together.
Yeah.
And so what I don't understand is why.
Well, didn't you say the director of Delirious was also the director of Superman 4?
No.
No?
So Superman 4 was directed by nobody. I mean, it was produced by Cannon.
Never mind.
By Golan and Globus.
Okay.
But Richard Donner, I think, was involved with producing Delirious, and he directed the first 1.5 Superman movies.
Okay.
So I don't understand why they would have a nod to...
The fourth one.
Superman 4, yeah, which came out in, like, you know, 87, a couple years before, in this film.
I don't know either.
It would be like you taking over the Harry Potter series, right?
Sure.
And doing, let's say that you direct the third Fantastic Beasts movie.
Sure.
And you making a joke about... A movie that you making a joke about Home Alone, a movie that Christopher Columbus directed,
right?
Who directed the first two Harry Potter movies,
right?
In your Harry Potter movie,
but it doesn't. Like, why would I do that?
I don't know.
Why is that a joke? Why is that an in joke?
I don't know.
It's so weird.
Yeah,
it's so random.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, if you had had, I don't know, Christopher Reeve walk by and be like, "Oh, I think you're gonna do a great job," or something
right.
like that.
Right.
Maybe that. I don't know. Maybe that would have had something else to do with it. The plot. Let's get to the plot. Jack is, like we said, fighting with the producers of his show. He is worried because the star that he's in love with is very self-absorbed. And it seems like she has this on-again, off-again relationship with the sledgehammer guy.
Yep.
He wants to sort of make it happen with her.
Yep.
But it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
No.
And he bangs his head on the trunk of his car. He's
yep.
going out to Vermont. It's a long story. And he wakes up seemingly... In his show.
Yeah.
At first he thinks he's on the set of his show because he wakes up and he's attended to by
the
Dr. Sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Sledgehammer.
And his nurse, who we know that he's having an affair with.
Right.
And so he's like, all right, guys, you got me. Okay. And it becomes very clear that like he goes outside, he looks outside the hospital room.
Uh-huh.
He's like, whoa, when did we build all this?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't go to a set like it's or to the back soundstage. Like
right.
It's an actual hospital.
Right.
We're going to go over budget. And there are a lot of kind of jokes like that. There aren't enough, though.
No.
This movie has an identity problem.
A little bit.
I think it's... I hesitate to say that it's underwritten, but it's definitely underwritten to its premise.
Well, the problem, I think, stems from the fact that the movie starts off super goofy and is not realistic at all.
No. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, there's a point where he... enters, so he wakes up inside his own sitcom, and I should finish off here. We find that he learns that he can type things on his typewriter. He can
yeah.
write things, and they become true in the world of the show, which leads to things like, and I want to say right away, I'm very proud of them for not being rapey about it. It would be really easy for him. He's in this fake world. Already
wow.
he doesn't believe that these people are really real, you know? So why not sit down and immediately write, do a typing roofie. Rachel loves the stranger from out of town, right? He never does that.
No, he doesn't.
He because he writes himself in as Jack Gates, which
yes.
is a character that he had already sort of pitched to the producers before.
This mysterious newcomer.
Yes, who's
the
very
Wolf
clearly based
Street.
On his idea of him. Yeah, called the Wolf of Wall Street, strangely enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he ends up becoming this character. So everybody thinks that he's come in from out of town to buy this secret formula that the crazy mad scientist, kooky doctor that lives in town has been working on. That's
mm-hmm.
a weight loss pill, basically.
Yep.
And he writes himself in ways where... And there's a cool thing. We get everything set up. When he's talking to the producers, they talk about everything that's going to happen on the show. So they say, we don't like the Rachel character. We're going to get rid of her. She's going to have a horse riding accident.
Yep.
And so he meets that character when he's in the soap opera, and he's like, I don't really know how to explain, you know. And she's like, I feel like we've met before. And he can't really connect with her.
Right.
Later on, he hears that she's going horseback riding. He's like, she's going horseback riding? Oh, no.
They're
going
to kill her.
Yeah. And so the movie is at its best, I think, when it's playing this thing where he's sort of working against the unseen writers.
Right.
Because they're doing everything they said they're going to do. And so he writes himself into the story as like this dashing hero on the horse. And he comes out and he... you know, rides, steeplechase sort of thing, and he
right.
chases her horse down, and he stops it, and he's like, 'twas nothing, madam.
Yeah.
You know, and then she's like, who was that? And that's what he does, instead of sort of writing her to love him.
Right.
This movie is so tone-deaf in other ways that I'm amazed that they were able to keep above the rape line. Do you know
wow.
what I mean?
Wow. Yeah.
But they do. But the funny thing is that once the scene's over, he's only used to writing it up to cuts, right?
Yeah.
So then he's like, huh, that worked out pretty good. And he starts riding the horse away, and he doesn't know how to ride a horse because he hasn't written himself to do that. So now he's in trouble, and he has to be saved by Muriel Hemingway.
Yes.
Who's the character who, to be, well, I guess the spoilers, of course, for the film, you know, they get together at the end, but then they're probably more similar in age than you'd think.
Yeah, I think
But she still seems more like a mentor-mentee sort of little sister than a true romance.
Muriel Hemingway, who plays Janet in the soap, like, is not like her at all. And she's more like down to earth. She's kind of more like supposed to be kind of like the girl next door.
Right.
But he complains before he goes into this dream that, oh, we're bringing in Janet. I thought we agreed not to. She's so boring.
Yeah, she's a weird character, and she's a quirky character. I mean, this is early sort of Manic Pixie Dream Girl-ish type stuff. She has like a PhD. She works with ants in Africa, you know, and the insect, not the relations. And so,
yes.
So she, yeah, and it's weird because I don't think we ever talk about who created that character. It seems pretty clear that he didn't. Because he doesn't seem to like the character very much.
Right.
But yeah, she does grow as kind of a love interest for him. And so anyway, he finds out that he has this power. The movie is ostensibly about him trying to get Rachel to fall in love with him while avoiding or having to involve himself in the machinations of the plot of this soap opera. And so the Muriel Hemingway character, her father was the scientist that was developing the formula.
Yes.
The formula is the MacGuffin here. And so guys come from out of town to, like, beat her up, you know, and, like, threaten her. And Candy writes himself in, of course, again, as Jack Gates, this flamboyant character. He bursts through a stained glass window
you know,
and beats the crap out of them and everything. And it sort of impresses Muriel Hemingway that way. And they start to get closer. But then the real Jack Gates shows up.
Yes.
The real Jack Gates is played by Robert Wagner.
Yeah.
Playing Robert Wagner.
Yes.
Which is like, it's a cute little thing.
It is.
Although John Candy's character remarks like, you don't do TV.
Right.
Heart to heart. MF, are you kidding? Like, that's where, he's a TV star. That's exactly what he is.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know.
Well.
I mean, he's a great choice for that. But if they were, had some, like a movie star on the line. Like, maybe Michael Caine was going to do it, and then he had to back out or something.
I don't know.
Because that would be great. He comes in and shoots him with a shotgun at the end of the thing. It's a very, like, Carter-esque kind of moment. Like, Michael Caine would have been perfect for that role.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, he's trying to keep the formula out of the hands of these guys, but really, John Candy's not invested, or I should say Jack's not invested, because although he knows that these people are real-ish, it still doesn't seem real to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he uses his typewriter whenever he can to sort of get out of situations. There's one point where, and it features something that you don't really see a lot in movies anymore, just like open binge drinking.
Yeah.
Like, you look at Ghostbusters, they're all smoking.
Yep.
And there isn't any, like, you know, you should really quit. There's none of that. Like, they're all just casually smoking.
Yep.
And this has, like, what I think you'd see a lot in films at the time where, boy, I don't, it's a comedy, but it's like, boy, I feel really depressed. And I'm just like fisting a bottle of my Canadian Club.
Yep.
It's mechanical in this, though, because there's a scene where he knows that the big announcement is tomorrow. Like, Raymond Burr is having everybody over because he's going to announce Dr. Sledgehammer's engagement to Rachel. And he's distraught over this. So he gets, like, tanked and writes like this giant scene where he's just gonna fix everything and take care of it, but as he gets more and more drunk, it affects what happens.
Yeah.
So he wakes up the next morning, he's not sure what he wrote, and he goes to the scene. For me, this is what the entire movie should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, it seems like an Eddie Murphy movie, like a late period Eddie Murphy movie. Like, it's really high concept, but this is where you get to do the fun things.
Yeah.
And so he writes like, then he comes in. And he's playing like a piano concerto because, of course, he can do that. And they're like, how long is this guy going to play the piano?
Right.
And then he finishes and she's like, it's amazing. And then he grabs her and they run out to the courtyard where like there's a Count Basie like orchestra out there. And they do like this big dance number that they both did. The actors did that dance number.
Yeah.
Very graceful, John Candy. And he comes back in and he's like, that was great. And then like this cheerleader runs in. And he's
from
like,
his high school.
Wait a minute. You're the girl that I liked in high school. She's like, yeah, you're so great. Give me a J. Give me an A. And he's like, what else did I write into this thing?
Yes.
And then he's you know, drunk, so he's, you know, misspelled things. And so at one point, the stewards bring in these reindeer, and he's like, "What is this? You said you wanted more cold deer."
He's like, "Beer."
Oh, no, it was beer, which is, yeah, silly, but
cheesy.
The whole film could have been that.
Yeah,
and I feel like they don't lean on their premise nearly enough.
No,
they
I
rely
don't think
on
they do.
They're kind of like goofy, not soap that opera. Funny jokes, and John Candy laughing. I used to love John Candy's laugh. I think I hate it now.
Oh,
he does it so much in this.
It's just overused.
And it's one thing for him to be Uncle Buck and to come into a situation with the best of intentions and completely, completely screw it up,
mm-hmm.
and be caught holding the bag. And he's like,
oh. Right.
Every time there's a pause because some joke has fallen flat, he just goes to that thing. And you're like, oh, why should we like this guy?
I know. I know. It's my biggest problem with the film overall is that it's so cheesy and ridiculous, and we've got goofy stunts right from the beginning.
Yeah.
So to me, the quote unquote real world is,
oh, it's just
it's
as
not
as
that different
outsized
from
as
the soap
as
opera
soap world. Yeah.
And to me, that should be a huge contrast.
Did you want like a Last Action Hero kind of thing?
I don't know.
Because they really pushed it in that. You know, in the Jack Slater universe, it's like bright L.A. and it's all like bikini models and like strong men walking around. But the real world is like horrible. Like way horrible. Like he gets mugged like outside of his apartment.
Right.
Like he's a latchkey kid. And it's just terrible. And I thought that was too much.
I don't know if I want it that extreme, but I just wanted to be able, I think that the tones should have been different. And
yeah.
I think maybe also it would have been cool if it had looked different too.
Oh, this movie,
you know
looks
what I mean?
Ancient. Now this came out in 1991.
I know, but I mean, if the soap opera parts had looked different from the quote unquote real world.
Different.
Like, different filter or something. You
like
know?
Pleasantville.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of people compare this to Pleasantville. Maybe set it like in another era, like it takes place in like the 40s,
right?
The soap opera, but yeah, but so that's too high production values for a soap opera, though. The whole point is to make them cheap. Yeah, I agree with you, but as far as the visual look goes, this movie looks ancient. This
it
came
does.
Out, yeah. It looks like it was made in the late 70s, early 80s. Well, with the fashions, the early 80s. Like it's terrible, and it. Part of it might be the sort of print of the copy that we saw. But when you think about it, Terminator 2, which
yes.
cost 10 times more than this. This cost $18 million and only made 5.5 at the box office. So
wow.
Not a success. And a lot of people think that this is one of the things that pretty much was the end of his career. Like he died making Wagons East, which is generally known as like the worst John Candy movie. And this directly led to that. Like,
uh-huh.
So anyway, but it looks terrible. And T2 came out the same year, and it looks amazing.
Yeah.
Now, you can still see the poofy hair and the, you know, we're still kind of ramping down from the 80s. But
right.
Just in terms of, like, film stock and quality, like, it just looks so much better.
Yeah.
And it blows my mind to think that The Matrix and Fight Club were made only 8 years later.
Yes.
And they look like they were made now.
I know. I mean, this is so grainy. It looks very
well,
dated.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, it does. It the quality is just... It's not there.
$18 million is already a lot for a movie that looks this cheap.
Yes.
But if you're thinking, okay, cheap aesthetic, here's what we'll do. Make the real world look as real as possible, even if you have to be a little gritty.
Yeah.
And then when they go into the thing, make the soap world look exaggerated.
Yes.
Make it look like somehow a TV show.
Like rosy
Two and
or
a half
fuzzy
men
around
has,
the edges.
Is producing the entire world.
Yes.
Like Earth has been created by Chuck Lorre.
Yes.
All the props are too big and too colorful, you know, and everybody, like that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking of another meta TV movie, like Stay Tuned,
mm-hmm.
Where John Ritter, you know, gets this remote from the devil that allows them to go into like different TV shows and
sure.
stuff like that. So, yeah, it's got that kind of thing. Like
yeah.
The whole movie is meta. I think it's interesting. I'm not even sure they understood the pill, the joke. I just blew it, but the meta pill. Is like the MacGuffin in this. And I think that that's based on it being something that affects your metabolism, so it's a meta pill. But I'm not sure this movie's even smart enough to know that they're making a metatextual joke.
I don't think that they are.
No, I don't think they are either.
And that's a little bit too bad, honestly.
It is too bad. I like I said before, I think that the best parts or the most interesting parts in my mind come from the conflict between sort of the unseen writers. Like, my question is, it turns out to all be a dream. Mm-hmm. Because of course it is. Like, there's no blue fairy. Like, what actually happens?
Right.
Although the ending of the movie kind of makes that fuzzy, because how does he know about the locks and the cream cheese, and why does the Nat King Cole song play in the diner and all that?
Right.
Does he have power? I don't know. Again, they didn't think about it. But so does he just show up in the show or something? Like,
I don't think
back in the real world, they're producing this show. Uh-huh. Is he like acting? Does he cast himself in a role in the show? Like, what's?
No, I don't think so.
There's no practical way to explain it,
because they're still doing the callbacks for Rachel when he wakes up.
Yeah.
And
no. It totally rewinds back in time where it should have been.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that was just purely a dream. That's what I think.
Yeah.
And so inconsequential. But he knows he has to find Muriel Hemingway, because she's the right Janet, and she's going to replace Laura, and he now thinks Laura is a jerk.
Right, so which means that Schmendemann, the guy who is writing all this stuff, and he punches in the face in the end, was right all along. He was trying to write her out.
Yes.
And then you realize that she should be written out.
Yeah.
So the people you got mad at and the guy you punched were right.
Yeah, maybe you should have gotten mad at yourself. Maybe you should have realized that you learned something, John Candy, and
yeah, punch yourself.
Yeah, there you go.
You have to tell me if this is racist or not.
Okay.
You know, usually it's like, yo, is this racist? This is more like, oi, is this racist?
Wow.
The Sherwoods?
A little bit.
Are very Jewish.
They are very Jewish.
They are eating like corned beef every time you see them.
Yep. Yeah, and they're very New York Jew, I think, is really what they're getting across.
Yeah, but that's okay? As a stock character?
I mean, it is a stock character. I would say it's a little racist.
I mean,
it's
Jerry Orbach, his dad was Jewish.
Uh-huh.
His mom was a Roman Catholic.
Yeah,
so he's already kind of borderline.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
Okay.
I think it's a little... a little racist, to say the least. It's not as bad as we've seen in like other films, like Casino Royale, that we talked about a couple weeks ago, with the Americans showing up, and they were Native Americans, obviously played by not real Native Americans.
If they had been played by actual Native American actors, would you have been more okay with it?
More okay with it, but still not totally okay.
Because I like the joke. The Americans are here, and you think it's like, oh, so a bunch of cowboys are going to run in, but no, Indians come in instead.
I know. I think I would have been more okay with it. Yeah,
but the fact that it's a bunch of white guys in like war paint,
it's not okay.
Here's a question I had the other day, and I think it was coming up from that. You know that whole like, dun, 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 dun. That's like stock Indian music.
Yes,
and there's quotes around every.
Yes.
Every word in that last phrase. Where do we get that from?
I have no idea.
When I was in like fourth grade band, which is like the first band that you can be in,
uh-huh.
We played a song called Apache Warrior, and I think it was that exact song. Now, that song is gone. Well, in our state, it probably still is being played by fourth graders in some other state.
Right.
But why that? Why do
I have,
we...
I have no
why
idea.
Why is that Indian? I'm going to look it up.
Okay.
I'm going to look it up.
All right. I'm curious to find out, so let me know what you find.
I'm going to ask my Native American friend.
Stop.
if he doesn't punch me, I'll get you an answer. So anyway, yeah, like I said, I just wish that there was more sort of interplay with him writing things, not to just solve whatever kind of stupid thing the writers of the film came up with,
mm-hmm.
but more tension and pull between him and Schmendemann on the outside that we don't see. It reminds me of those cartoons where Daffy Duck would get in a fight with the animator. Remember those like old Wonder Bread things?
Yes.
Where he'd be like, all right, mister, if we're going to do this, then I'm going to need a thing. And then he'd like paint a silly hat on his head. And he's like,
no!
You think this is funny, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like that sort of thing. Like he is trying to furiously counteract like the weird and horrible things that the writer is inflicting on him.
Yes. And he thinks it's the writer that he feels like he's competing with. And like,
oh, maybe he ends up with some respect for Schmendemann.
No, because he punches them in the face.
No, but I'm saying, let's fix the movie. Like,
oh,
maybe he realizes that,
his stuff is kind of hacky. That would be more interesting.
So he's a hacky writer on the outside. He's the guy that gives people brain tumors, but he gets into it and he writes stuff for these characters. And he realizes that's kind of dumb. And we could keep it light. We keep it funny still. But he starts to like see these people as real people, and so therefore he's, you know, he's got like the great American novel in him that he's trying to write while he's got this hacky job writing soaps.
Sure.
And so he starts to write more sort of real things for them, because he brings complete chaos to the town of Ashford Falls.
Yeah.
And it isn't all his fault. You get the feeling that it was already pretty crazy on this show.
Yep.
But we end with the doctor trying to shoot himself.
Mm-hmm.
The one brother loses his other eye.
Yes.
And then the other brother has like a goiter and his teeth are falling out because he's been given extra medication to fix his headache, which is probably going to turn into a brain tumor in later seasons.
Right.
And that's none of that is his John Candy's fault.
No.
He's in the show when all that's happening.
Yeah.
So, again, that could be just a reaction by the writers trying to fix the craziness that's happening in the show.
Uh-huh.
But none of it feels or seems very real at all. So maybe he tries to bring, like, more... Maybe he could help people with his typewriter. You
sure.
know, and make things better. Because now he's got to live here in Pleasantville. I mean, Ashford Falls. But we don't get that.
Well, and I think that would have been a more interesting choice because I think that his character would have changed more then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He doesn't change at all.
Besides his opinion on Laura, that's the only thing that really changes.
The only thing that happens is that he basically uses... So he doesn't learn the Heimlich, but he uses the Heimlich in the show.
Yes.
Because he writes it in.
Yes. So then he knows it in the real world.
So you think he didn't know it before?
I almost feel like he didn't.
Well, anyway, he just comes out and he basically wins, like, real life the way he was winning the soap opera.
Yeah.
Without really learning any moral lesson. And then he pays attention to Marilyn Hemingway instead of kind of ignoring her before. And that's all we get in terms of a character journey.
Yep. And then we get a scene of them walking through a park and she's holding some balloons for some reason.
Well, they
and
go
then,
skating.
And then they go skating.
Yeah.
And it just seems like some random scenes.
That's something else. Speaking
together.
Of how old this looks, like, New York still looks like New York.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's pre-Giuliani for sure, but it's pre-everything. I actually looked, so the cable guy is at a Sbarro's.
Yes.
In New York. And he gets in his van, and the joke is that, you know, he's the cable guy's late, you know, because he's off getting his shoe shined and stuff. But I actually looked at the corner where that Sbarro's is. It's on like 7th and 33rd or something like that in Midtown. And it looks like an Al Pacino movie from the 70s in that shot. Now, if you look at like Google Maps or Street View, it looks like Ghost in the Shell.
Really?
Like there are billboards everywhere, moving faces. This is about maybe like 8 to 10 blocks like south of Times Square, but it's now like a metropolis of the future. So this movie, even in 91, you think that it would be a little more developed.
Right.
But they somehow capture New York at this sort of like pre, you know, new New York theme park welcomes you. You must be this tall to ride. It's an interesting look.
It is.
That we get 2 seconds of before we got to get into Ashford Falls.
Yeah.
Ashford Falls. Anything you liked about the film? Other than what we talked about?
I don't know.
Talk about Len?
I guess.
Talk about Len.
You kind of wanted to talk about Len, but so there's this character named Len in Ashford Falls, and he like isn't even in the actual TV show anymore, but he shows up in Jack Gable or John Candy's dream.
That's a thing that they sort of set up, well, at least in the dream, is that the entire world still exists, even if they've sort of haven't gone to certain scenes or places anymore, or they've kind of written characters out.
Yeah,
unless they have died, they're still in the world of the town. It's like, you know, we don't see a mob guy on The Simpsons all the time, Fat Tony or whatever, but he's still out there.
He's still there.
Yeah, but Bleeding Gums Murphy is not. He's dead.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So Len is I guess, he's like, oh, man, we got so many letters about Len. And so implying that he's kind of a troublesome character, but it's not really clear in what way. So Len is a mechanic. He's good at his job, but he also is like a cross-dresser, and he, you know, is wearing his hair long and earrings and a necklace.
He's got like,
and,
a knit rainbow halter.
Rainbow halter, yeah. And like admiring himself in the mirror. So it's like, not sure if this is a, you know, for taking a dig at at people who are cross-dressers and gay people in general, or if we're taking a dig at somebody who's different from us, and so that therefore they make us uncomfortable.
Do I talk now?
Yes.
Here's what I've got to say about it.
Okay.
This movie is so... The one sort of mean-spirited joke they make is about Cleveland.
Oh, yeah. They do not like Cleveland.
That or Detroit are pretty big punching bags for, like, comedies of the era.
Yeah.
The Mistake by the Lake.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is very non-mean-spirited.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
And the sexual politics of the early 90s, I'm not trying to say that they are particularly advanced, but I don't think that it's... I think it's a sight gag more than anything else.
I guess.
Maybe it isn't totally open-minded to find it hilarious that a character is wearing something non-traditional that you wouldn't expect them to be wearing.
Right.
But he's dressed so outlandishly that I think it just operates. It's supposed to operate as a sight gag. I don't think the filmmakers are like, it's queer. I don't think they're doing anything like that.
Right.
And the reason is because... They don't make... He's not actually in the movie a whole bunch.
No.
And they don't make any reference to his orientation. He doesn't really get to interact with any of the characters.
No.
And in his second scene, he even comes out on top. Like, he gets the laugh line.
Right.
Because after... during the film, Jack does this thing with Rachel where he blindfolds himself. He's driving his Ferrari, which is actually like a Datsun that they reworked to look like a Ferrari. Like, it's not an actual Ferrari. Because they couldn't afford it. And so he plays this like chicken game where he's driving. Now, of course, if he writes that
he
they don't crash,
that.
They
yeah.
don't crash.
Yeah.
But then later on, she tries to get her doctor boyfriend to play the game. And we smash cut to them pulling him out of a river.
Yes.
And then he makes, there's some a little bit of dialogue. And then they go back to the guy and he's like petrified. And they cut back to Len, who's in full costume. And he's running the tow truck. He's pulling the thing. And he looks at the guy and he's just like, this guy.
Yeah.
And it's a great, I don't know, it's a great moment.
It is
and
a good
so,
moment.
I don't know, I just, yeah. I don't think that you would do something like that today.
No.
But on a scale of 1 to 10 cringes, when you look back at like earlier works,
yeah,
I think it's a 1.
Okay.
I think you can just kind of go, all right.
Yeah.
That was just so shocking for the audience you were aiming this at in 1991.
Not as bad as Teen Wolf.
No.
You know.
I'd still put Teen Wolf at like a 3 or 4.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a lot of like F words being just tossed around.
It's a little insensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've said pretty much everything that I liked about the movie. I think that it like had potential that they didn't really dig into. Also, Robert Wagner, I mean, I love Heart to Heart, but it's not like he's a really great actor.
He was pretty much playing himself.
Yeah.
That's
Heart to Heart, too.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I wish they had pushed the envelope a little bit more with us.
Yeah.
But would you recommend it? I would not recommend it.
I don't think I would either. I mean, if you want to be, you always like to talk about being a completionist. If you want to be a John Candy completionist, it's easy.
Yeah.
It's not too tough to do. He doesn't have that many movies because of how soon that he passed. So, yeah, I would say do it for that reason. Other than that, I just don't think that there's not really a lot that you really need to get out of this.
Mm-mm.
Even guys like Charles Rocket are not given a lot to do.
Yeah, no.
Sadly, he's another guy who's really famous or funny and relatively famous. He's got that one thing, but his character can't do anything right, and so he's got this thing where he gets really mad and he like grabs this Ming vase.
Yes,
and he throws it on the ground, and it bounces back up, and he's like, you couldn't even do that right.
I know.
That's about it. But that is a pretty stretching of reality.
Yes.
And the suspension of disbelief. 44% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Not great.
No.
But that's okay. That's okay. Because the next film we're going to do is even worse.
Oh, boy.
Staying with our theme of creators and writers and the things that they create, we are going to check out Where the Buffalo Roam, the 1980 movie starring Bill Murray, loosely based, but still more realistically based on the life of Hunter S. Thompson.
All right.
It is actually about him. This isn't going to be a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas thing.
Okay.
Where we focus on a fictionalized, Duke fictionalized version of Hunter S. Thompson. This is actually about his life, although the events are fictitious.
Okay. All right. I'm intrigued.
Yeah. It's got Bill Murray. It's got Peter.
That's good.
Yeah, it's got Peter Boyle in it. Okay. How could a movie like the one I'm describing be 17% on Rotten Tomatoes?
I don't know.
We're going to find out together next time on Craft to Services. So anyway, that is our show. Thanks for joining us. I hope we got you out of here somewhat on time. I think we did. Join us on our social media outlets online. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And I also want to direct you to our site, justenoughtrope.com, where if you're not already getting the show there, you can find the show links posted every time there's a show, which is twice weekly, of course, the beginning of the week and the end of the week, with some exceptions. Either in the more or the less category. Sometimes we sneak little bonus shows in there. And also, I want to direct you to the Amazon link on our page. Through the Amazon affiliate program, when you go to Amazon through our page and make any kind of purchase at all, they send a little bit back to us, and it keeps the lights on around here. So I'd appreciate it if you go to our page, and you can make a bookmark off of the Amazon banner link on our page. And then from then on, whenever you want to go to Amazon to buy whatever it might be, you click that bookmark. It knows that you've come to Amazon through us, and we might get a little change off of that.
There you go.
So that's a new thing we're trying out, and I hope that you try it out, too, the next time you want to buy, say, Delirious. We should really, if we were doing our market synergy right, we would do good films that people would want to go buy.
Yes.
But for John Candy completionists, you know where that link is. You can also find the show on iTunes. Go to our show page by searching for Just Enough Trope on iTunes. You can find us there and subscribe to the show. Go ahead and do that. If you're not getting it on the page, like we said, you can get it off iTunes as soon as it's ready. It'll come right to you. Also, give us a review while you're there because we love to hear from the fans. Love to hear how you think we're doing and some of those John Candy movies that you think are maybe worth your time or our time. I'm trying to think, man. Uncle Buck is not a great movie, but it's a fun movie.
It is a fun movie. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles
is
pretty
that's
funny.
A pretty good one. That's a classic one.
I think that's a solid one.
Other than that, I'm coming up
it's
somewhat
hard.
Short.
I mean, he was in Home Alone, which is a good movie.
He was. It had a tiny little part in Home Alone. And a very funny scene. That's true. So
Spaceballs.
Yes,
I
of
like
course.
Spaceballs.
We've already said this. We've.
I know.
The well is dry. It's dry. So yeah. Anyway, a review would be great from you. And while you're there, give us a rating too. When you give us a high rating, it's better for the show. iTunes knows we're doing a good job. We move up in the ranks, and everybody gets to get what they want. So I'd say give us 5 cold deer. I mean beers. That's a tough one, too, because the plural of deer is deer, but the plural of beers is beers?
Yes.
Or get more cold beer just means, I guess, general beer.
I guess general.
I mean, it's tricky, though.
It is tricky.
It's tricky.
Yes.
You've rhymed deer with beer. Amazing.
Yes.
You're the poet laureate. Also, B isn't really all that close to D. You wouldn't use that finger.
No, you're
so,
right.
So however drunk you are. On you, beer or deer, I don't think you would make that mistake.
No.
It'd be more like fear.
Yeah.
F-E-E-R.
Yes.
So it'd be like, ooh, cold fear. He's like, boy, I suddenly feel really scared for some reason.
Right.
So just give us 5 cars instead. Oh, I mean stars. We'd really appreciate it. Well, we're ready to sign off for tonight. I want to remind our listeners that we're very excited to have Comfort Love and Adam Withers on our next show. Friday, we are reading and reviewing the first volume of The Uniques, their comic book about young heroes in a world of heroes, in a world where New York has exploded. There is no New York.
Yeah.
A bunch of young heroes try to follow in the footsteps of their mentors and older heroes that have been lost in this tragedy, and they're trying to make their way in the big city or something like that.
Yes.
We'll talk all about that, and we have an interview, a great long interview with Comfort and Adam, who are two exciting and fun individuals to talk to. They have a lot of really strong opinions about the industry that they're involved in, and I think that is so cool to see because they aren't just yeah, whatever. They're not just Frank Cho-ing it. I'll just take the work. Like, right. They want to change the industry they're in.
Yes.
And I think that they're going to succeed in doing that. So come back and join us for that. That's it. We're done. I'm signing off. I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.